San Diego's Intelligent Talk, 1170 KCBQ.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Web Studio, Primetime Advertising Corporation, and the Law Office of Thomas Pinkerton. The views and opinions are solely those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent KCBQ or its sponsors. It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but in your mind, maybe a more loving God would do something about the horrific situation called global warming. Actually, according to many scientists and meteorologists, the world has been cooling these past 3 years. Hard to believe on a hot San Diego day like today. It's been kind of summer by day, winter by night, but we're not the only place on the planet. And even as I speak on this January day, there are record cold spells going on all over our country. What is the leftist response to global cooling? Some just ignore it. Since Al Gore told us the debate is over, anyone who disagrees must certainly be wrong. After all, Al won the Nobel Prize and the Academy Award. So what would some mere meteorologist know? Tamper told me not to ever get a new Oscar. Instead, we'll just recycle the old Oscar. Others explain that the cooling is really a byproduct of the melting polar ice caps. Yeah, you see, this causes a chain reaction in the weather, which means that, well, yeah, sure, some places will get colder, but clearly this is due to global warming, and you just darn better believe it, bub. Still others have abandoned the phrase global warming and have replaced it with climate change. This is the most clever maneuver of all. Now, no matter what happens weather-wise, our own carbon emissions must have caused it, be it rain, shine, sleet, or snow. Why does the government have such a vested interest in politically correct weather? I'll tell you why. Because people who want to control others never come out and admit that they want to control others. Instead, they look for an opportunity to worm their way into our lives, no pun intended. And solving an alleged crisis is the best scenario money can buy. Did you notice our Democratic Congress salivating as the auto industry CEOs asked for a bailout? Sure, we'll give you the money, but in return, you will make the kinds of cars we tell you to make, with the kinds of emission controls we mandate. Say goodbye to those evil SUVs. What kind of cars will we allow? Oh, let's just say something one step ahead of a horse and buggy. Come to think of it, we might actually return to the horse and buggy someday, but we'll discuss that one later. We even had a town in Connecticut tell people how long they could keep up their Christmas lights because somehow Christmas lights also contribute to climate change. When asked to explain what Christmas lights had to do with global warming, one of the councilmen said, they are not Christmas lights. They are holiday lights. You see my point? The leftist agenda has found its perfect storm. Remember the story of Chicken Little? You heard that as a kid, Chicken Little. An acorn fell on his head, so he and his friends went to tell the king that the sky was falling. Along the way, Foxy Loxy offered to accompany the merry little band. By the end of the trip, Foxy Loxy had eaten Henny Penny, Turkey Lurkey, Ducky Lucky, and finally Chicken Little himself. The king never did find out that the sky was falling, but then again, it didn't matter because the sky never fell anyway. And this was not the last time deception came from a word spelled acorn. Someday, shivering around the fireplace on a cold winter day, we will tell stories to our grandchildren such as Chicken Little, global warming, and other fairy tales. So, did the planet really change, Grandpa?
Well, the climate didn't change, Junior.
But yes, our lives on this planet did change. They changed indeed. Better get to bed now. We are only allowed to light the fireplace for 1 hour. Besides, it's a 3-hour walk to school tomorrow, and while I'm walking you, I need extra time to stop off and pay our walking tax for the research of biodegradable shoe material. But there is some good news this week. In fact, this story is being hailed as the most positive piece of popular news to hit Americans in quite some time. A refreshing change from the war on terror and the bad economy. A U.S. Airlines jet, after potentially crashing in New York City, instead landed in the Hudson River, where many brave people rescued every single passenger. There were no fatalities. All survivors. This is virtually unprecedented in a large plane crash. Now, let me offer two observations this afternoon. First, let's just hope the skill of the pilot, the heroics of the rescuers, and the innocence of the airline ward off any temptation of a lawsuit. I mean, you know what I'm talking about. Forgive me for feeling cynical, but I can just sense attorneys salivating all over the country, turning this into a more conventional news story with Geraldo and Greta Van Susteren. Had the plane taken off from another runway, had there been no Hudson River to land in, we might be talking about a crash into buildings, not unlike the 9/11 disaster. Should one be grateful before God? I believe so. Now, before my skeptical friends snicker, I remind them how quick they are to blame God or deny God when things go wrong. Well, when something goes conspicuously right, they tend to ignore the situation. Please don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying this incident proves the existence of God. That can be done in other ways. On the other hand, if people choose to put theology on trial for lack of divine intervention toward plane crashes and other disasters, then an amazing set of positive events, at the very least, should be taken into consideration as evidence for God. It would be difficult for any honest, free-thinking individual to not at least consider this possibility. Continuing now with the news, have you heard the latest? There is a website by an anonymous source that lists and maps the names and addresses of all people who made donations to Proposition 8. Did you make a donation to Proposition 8? If it was over a certain amount, you're on this website. Since contributions are a matter of public record, this evidently was not a difficult task with internet usage. And so, some sniveling coward who will not offer his own name and address provides the identity and location of others. For what purpose? Why would anyone possibly do such a thing, apart from the intention to invite vandalism, intimidation, or maybe even violence against those who use their constitutional right to promote a cause? You may notice I'm not repeating the name of the website. That's deliberate, because many listen to this radio show and many read my blog, and I am here to condemn the site. I'm not here to advertise the site. But I'm sure this self-righteous, sanctimonious individual is patting himself on the back for defending gay marriage and labeling the intolerant people. Honestly, I'm of the opinion that the word tolerant should just be removed from our dictionary once and for all until our country's ever-receding brain figures out how to actually read and understand the original definition. Once upon a time, that word meant that we should allow for opinions other than our own, whether we think our views are politically correct or not. Well, for those of you who think I only critique the left on this show, you may find what I'm about to say extremely interesting. One thing the extreme left and the extreme right have in common is anti-Semitism. Now, as a conservative, not an extreme right conservative, but as a conservative, I often find myself agreeing with the likes of Pat Buchanan. But then Buchanan goes and makes ridiculously stupid comments such as, Jews have exaggerated the Holocaust. Now, that's been an old one of Pat's for years. This week's comment, not one Israeli has been killed by the missiles of Hamas, and therefore their attack upon Gaza is completely unwarranted. Not one Israeli killed from missiles? Pat, how do you say this stuff with a straight face? Even though Hamas has been firing rockets at Israel for over 3 years? I guess these must have been peaceful missiles, with little attached notes about brotherhood. Yes, indeed, Hamas plans to spread tranquility across the land. Now, according to Fox News, let me read this report from Fox News. Hamas is listed as a terrorist organization by the United States and many other Western nations. From 2000 to 2004, Hamas was responsible for killing nearly 400 Israelis and wounding more than 2,000 in 425 attacks, according to the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs. From 2001 through May 2008, Hamas launched more than 3,000 Qassam rockets to 2,500 mortar attacks against Israeli targets. And here's a quote from Hamas. "We are waiting for you to enter Gaza to kill you or make you into shallots," the group said, referring to Israeli Sergeant Gilead Shalit, who was captured in a cross-border raid by Hamas-affiliated militants 2.5 years ago and remains in captivity in Gaza. But Buchanan calls Gaza an Israeli-run concentration camp. He also refers to the present incursion as a blitzkrieg. Now, I think you know that the term concentration camp and blitzkrieg, those are both Nazi terms. I hope our friend Pat is feeling a surge of satisfaction by comparing Nazi victims to the Nazis themselves. I mean, is this disgusting or what? Indeed, Israel pulled out of Gaza several years ago. Why? So that the Palestinians could finally have their own state, their state which they turned down again and again. But now they can have one. In return, what did the Palestinians do? They burned down all Jewish synagogues. They destroyed greenhouses paid for with literally billions of dollars by Israelis and other philanthropists so that the peace-loving Palestinian victims could do some farming. But you see, the greenhouses were contaminated with Jewish germs, and so they had to go. Oh, and let's not forget that rockets are being smuggled in through Egyptian tunnels. Why? How's this possible? Well, this is because in the days of our stellar President Jimmy Carter, Israel gave the Sinai back to Egypt in exchange for peace. The same Sinai that was taken from Egypt in 1967 as a result of Egyptian President Nasser promising to kill every Jewish man, woman, and child. You know, Pat, when you speak on subjects other than Israel, you sometimes make sense. But your blatant anti-Semitism seems to give your better constructed thoughts a kind of Sabbath. Pardon the Jewish expression. I know you probably don't like Jewish expressions very much. And before we leave the Middle East, what is the difference between Hamas and the Palestinian authorities? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. That is, nothing in their objectives. It's just that Hamas is a bit more honest in its openly stated goal of liquidating Israel. On the office wall of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, there is a map of Palestine. The map includes the entire area that currently belongs to Israel, and Israel is not on the map at all. Should we be surprised in as much as the man is a Holocaust denier? Abbas talks about peace and claims to welcome a two-state solution, but the truth is he is only delaying the inevitable to gain world sympathy. His own Fatah party was once listed as a terrorist organization before they started kissing the behind of the United Nations. If Israel were to give back more land, the Fatah party would demand even more. If Israel completely returned to the pre-1967 borders, the Fatah party would then push for the right of return. That is code for Israel should not exist. Abbas is nothing more than Yasser Arafat in the soup. The only way Palestinians plan to share land is with the Israelis buried beneath them. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show. Looking to build your own website without a lot of cost and trouble? Hi, I'm Bob Siegel, here to tell you about Web Studio. Web Studio allows people to create their own websites simply and easily without knowing HTML. With Web Studio, you avoid the learning curve of front page and the expense of a web designer. Web Studio has 14 different galleries that contain graphics, sounds, and everything else you need. For more information about Web Studio, go to webstudio.com.
Hey, this is Lori K. Lewis, a frequent co-host on The Bob Siegel Show, Talk Radio 1170 on KCBQ. If you have questions or comments during this radio broadcast, please call Bob at this toll-free number, 1-888-344-1170. Again, the number is 1-888-344-1170. We'd like to hear what you have to say.
Back to Intelligent Talk 1170 KCBQ. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. If you would like to weigh in on some of the subjects we're talking about in the news, or if you have a theology comment or question about the Bible, our theme, Christianity and its relationship to politics and pop culture, give us a call. Toll-free number is 1-888-344-1170. That's 1-888-344-1170. For those of you shy about the radio, we also take email questions at bobsiegel.net. That's questions at Bob Siegel, SIEGEL.net. And concerning giving God credit for the survival of the U.S. Airlines plane in sea, writes, I agree. How else did those wings stay horizontal long enough for every person to be saved? On the other hand, Nils from Lemon Grove disagrees. He says, Bob, another skeptical response. If bad things are an accurate basis for denying God, then good things must be due to natural causes. If good things prove God, then there should be no bad things. You can't say that bad things deny the existence of God and good things prove his existence, because that makes no sense. He can't both exist and not exist at the same time. However, you can say that bad things deny God's existence, and so good things are just a coincidence. However, the truth is God is responsible, though not necessarily the cause of everything. In the last chapter of Job, the Bible writer blames the Lord God for all the evil Job had experienced, even though we know that Satan was the cause. Well, Nils, I do agree with your interpretation of Job. Let me be more clear with the point I was making. It is, Nils, the randomness of evil that atheists take issue with. If goodness then comes in ways that seem ordered and not random, that, I believe, is evidence for God's existence. But again, evidence and proof are not the same thing. The only way God can prove himself to somebody is if that person actually meets and experiences God through his spirit. Now, let me give you an example. Atheists all the time are talking about how there are all kinds of people that make prayers and God doesn't answer them, but they tend to shove it under the rug when God does answer one. There's one that I've even brought up at atheist debates of a time where I asked God for $100 because my church was asking each member to donate, and regardless of whether the church should have been doing that, and I wasn't sure myself that they should have been, I went to God and said, okay, if you give me $100 out of the blue, I will give it to the church. But I said, God, it's got to be exactly $100. If you give me $99.99, I will spend it myself, because I'm not convinced you want me to give this money to the church. 2 days after I made that prayer, days later, I get a letter from my friend John. He's a Christian brother, but he does not go to my church. I have not seen him for 6 months. He does nothing about the prayer I made. He knows nothing about our church asking people for the money. He sends me a little note, just a couple of lines. He says, Dear Bob, God recently blessed me with a large sum of money, and he laid it on my heart to give you this amount. And inside was a check for exactly $100. Now, when I talk to some of my atheist friends, there's a saying amongst atheists, and particularly those that are into philosophy, called Occam's Razor. Occam's Razor is a philosophical tool which says the simplest, most logical, most rational explanation is the one we should accept. There's only two possible explanations to this story, unless you want to assume that I'm lying. But I'm not. Isn't this a face you can trust? Look at your radio. Look at your radio right now. Is this a face you can trust or what? Okay, explanation number one, there is no God. When I asked God for $100, God didn't exist, so I was just talking to myself. Nobody heard me. And by an amazing coincidence, by incredible randomness and chance, 2 days after I made the prayer, the exact amount of money I asked for was given to me. Or explanation number two, there is a God. The reason God gave me $100 after I asked him, is he heard me, he really existed, and he gave it to me. And I've put this to the face of atheists, and I've said, now you tell me, which of those explanations is more logical? Some are honest, and they go, boy, that's pretty incredible. If something like that happened to me, I'd believe in God. Others go, well, that doesn't mean anything, because you need to do a statistical analysis and see if 500 people made the same prayer and how few are being answered as opposed to the majority that aren't answered. And I'm going, no. You can do anything you want with statistics. Sometimes you need to look at the incident itself within the perimeters of that incident. Forget the fact that sometimes people make prayers to God and they don't get answered. God can say no. People say no all the time. God can say no. God not answering a prayer means nothing other than the fact that the prayer was not answered. It may be because God doesn't exist. It may be because God chose not to answer it. When the prayer is answered, when we're talking not just about something randomly good, but something incredibly coincidentally good, in fact, too coincidental to even be viewed as a coincidence, then we have to deal with it. Does it take more faith to believe that when I asked God for $100, $100 by some fluke was given to me? Or does it take less faith to think, no, the reason I got the $100 is God was there? So that's what I mean in the situations with this plane, that just the amount of people that happened to be around to rescue them, the fact that here's this river that if the plane had taken off in any other way, he wouldn't have been able to land in it. It's a difficult river to land in. Planes aren't supposed to land in rivers. There's just so many things that lined up. And again, I'm not saying that proves God, but boy, that's pretty coincidentally good. It's pretty conspicuously good. And I would think that an open-minded atheist would at least take that into consideration as well. 1-888-344-1170 or questions at bobsiegel.net. And this is from our friend Peter in Maine, who writes to us a lot. And 2 weeks ago, not last week, but 2 weeks ago, I spent a lot of time on one of Peter's questions. And he was suggesting the possibility that it may make more sense to believe in a deist view of God. Deist view meaning a God who kind of winds the universe up like a watch and then just sits back and takes an uninterested, dispassionate look at what's going on. Peter suggested that because he thought that that's a better way to explain suffering. If this was a loving God who cares, then how could we explain suffering? So that's the gist of what he was writing. I had commented on it, and he says, hi, Bob. First, let me say that I am honored and sometimes a little surprised at the amount of time and energy you devote to looking at and responding to my questions and emails, especially when a fair amount of that time is on the air. I just listened to last Sunday's show off your website. I say surprised more from the perspective that I don't always think what I am saying is all that worthy of attention. I certainly am not surprised that you are such a caring, intelligent, and respectful person. Even though we have never met in person, I feel like I know you, and I call you a friend. I'll tell you more about what Peter in Maine had to say when we return. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show. This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785, that's 447-8785, for W&S Electric Incorporated, license number 480539, W&S Electric.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Emails, and you can reach us questions at bobsiegel.net, questions at bobsiegel, S-I-E-G-E-L bobsiegel.net. Before we went to the break, I was in the middle of an email from our friend Peter in Maine. A couple of weeks ago, I spent a lot of time on one of his email questions and comments, and he was expressing gratitude that I had spent so much time on it. And I'm happy to do that, Peter, because you do ask good and meaty questions. Well, he goes on and says, I want to respond to some of the comments you made about my email. My desire to respond is motivated more by the feeling that you may have misunderstood some of what I said, or perhaps I did not express myself as well as I could, and much less because of any disagreement. I probably agree with a good portion of what you said. My question is how you would prefer I respond, in writing, in another email, or by calling into your show on Sunday. I am not trying to invite myself on the show. I just thought I would check and see what mode of response would work best for you. And thanks again for being you. Warmly, Peter. Well, Peter, thank you for the kind words. You are always welcome to call the show anytime, and we're just as happy to get letters. So any way you want to do it is fine with me. To me, a question and a comment is a question and a comment. Of course, the advantage of calling in is we can dialogue about it too, especially if you think that I'm responding to something and may have misunderstood you. And I suppose that's possible. Stranger things have happened. Now, this is from Darlene in Lakeside. My opening monologue today was about global warming. I did a blog version of that on townhall.com. So Darlene's comment was on townhall.com. She says, Hi, Bob. I'm not saying I agree with everything the government has to say about global warming and the causes, but I also don't just throw out conservation in my life simply because I don't agree 100%. Whether it is a natural pattern that the Earth goes through or the fact that we put all kinds of garbage in our atmosphere, there is definitely a difference in our climate that even a non-scientifically trained person can see. It is that obvious. What is the reason she's using the word obvious a lot, by the way, is that I usually close most of my blogs by saying, this is Bob Siegel making the obvious obvious. So Darlene, in a friendly way, is making the point that there are some things that counter what I said, which she thinks is obvious. So she says, what isn't as obvious are the reasons for that change. But honestly, I would rather err on the side of being conservative and doing positive things that save our natural resources and save me money in the time of economic trouble. SUVs are gas guzzlers. When I can choose to drive our car that causes the lowest grade of fuel and has the highest gas mileage, and I try to carpool whenever possible, or I find myself just driving less. It sounds like Darlene's saying that she does have a bigger car, but a lot of times she chooses to drive the smaller one. And I think that's wonderful, Darlene, but I would hate to see the government tell you which car you're allowed to drive. I appreciate the choice you made. I'd just like to see you be able to continue making that choice. We serve a government that always claims it's pro-choice. Other than the choice for a woman to kill her own baby, there's very little choice that our ever-evolving leftist government seems to want to give us. They don't seem to want to give us a choice what to drive, what to eat. Anyway, I shouldn't be commenting so much because I haven't even finished Darlene's letter. Let the poor lady continue to speak for herself, Bob, for crying out loud. You like the way I bawl myself out? Okay, we'll continue with Darlene. Darlene says, I don't like paying money for gasoline when I have more interest in keeping my employees employed. I only keep the light on in the room in which I am sitting, working, etc. In fact, in my five offices at work, we don't even put lights on until the afternoon in order to conserve energy and money. And we dress cooler or warmer so that we don't have to use heat and AC as much. The office next door runs their AC all day so they can keep their sweaters on and be comfortable. Tell me that isn't wasteful. Keeping lights on when you don't need them is a waste of energy and money, regardless of whether it does or does not have a negative impact on the environment. And I did have Christmas lights up this year, but I made sure they were on a timer so that they were only on for a short while. If we weren't home, the lights were not on. I also recycle. Recycling does cut down on our wastefulness of products that can be used again and so on. No matter the reason, whether you are a staunch global warming advocate or simply a person trying to save a buck where you can, conservation is something we all need to do more of, and that is what is obvious. A little scientific evidence would be helpful to back up your opinion. Otherwise, I think the only thing you are making obvious is your opinion and not the reality of the subject you choose to blog about, Darlene. Well, Darlene, thank you for your comments. For starters, I do not always list info on every blog. It depends upon the style. Sometimes my purpose is brief political satire. Other times I am more detailed and forthcoming with specific information. Still, At the risk of sounding simplistic, I think record cold winters would count as a little scientific evidence, wouldn't it? Or at least evidence from a thermometer or evidence from an open window. Many scientists do display global warming. They have written articles that have always been around for anyone who wants to see them. Now, I'm not a scientist, and I would never claim to be. So I will leave it to others to write about science with the stats and hard data. My own concerns are in the areas of freedom. If some scientists are disputing global warming and others are not, then debate is in order. And the politically correct powers that be should not try to silence such debate. The only fact I was pointing to on my monologue today and on my blog a couple of days ago is that we are having a record cold winter, that the world has been cooling for the last 3 years, and that people are switching the term to climate change when before they insisted on the term global warming. Throughout history, there have been many periods of radical climate change apart from man, such as the Ice Age, this little thing called the Ice Age, and it's melting when no humans were even around yet. And in ancient Rome, when humans were around, there was also a time when the weather got warmer in an unusual way for many years. How did they pull that off before cars were invented? Now, having said that, freedom of speech and freedom to live our lives without government interference is always my chief concern. If somebody wants to believe in global warming, that is their business. But when they start telling the rest of us what to believe and that the debate is over, this I take issue with. I just don't think there's any subject on earth that cannot be debated. Now, Darlene, if you're interested, I could point you to meteorologists who do not believe we are responsible for global warming. For example, John Coleman jumps to my mind. He invented the Weather Channel. He is a meteorologist, and I have used his name before on my blog and on my radio show. And paleoclimatologist Dr. Tim Patterson, a professor in the Department of Earth Sciences at Carleton University, he would be another reference. Finally, a 2007 Senate report referred to 400 prominent scientists around the world who either dismissed global warming or at least were not convinced that people had anything to do with it. Now, Darlene, I do agree that we should conserve. And my point about the Christmas lights was only that a city council in Connecticut was using global warming as an excuse to challenge the legalities of using the term Christmas. And I doubt that conservation was their honest agenda. Well, here's a comment from Mike in Champaign, Illinois, responding to my blog and my dialogue with Darlene. Mike says, well said. I've got several articles with more science on them if you're interested. I disagree with Rush that just because there are PC kooks out there, we should go out and buy an SUV just to show them what we think of them. I agree with her point about saving money. And as a true conservative and Christian, I want to conserve. We're stewards, and all the marketing in the world shouldn't get us to consume what we don't need, or at least can find some far-off justification for. On the other hand, I'm also a true classic liberal in that I think these things need to be debated, unlike many of the leftist PC global warming advocates who are more ditto heads than any of Rush's listeners ever thought of being. Oh, well, thanks for your provocative thinking. Blessings, Mike. Thank you, Mike, and we'll be right back.
How many times have you heard the phrase, they're all the same, applied to local contractors? It is unfortunate that a few can tarnish the reputations of many, but it sure is nice when you find a contractor with godly principles. But what if they only do floors or only the painting? What if you want to build a whole new home? Or you want someone to fully complete your remodel or tenant improvements? You need ProBuilt. Serving San Diego since 1987, residential and commercial, quality work, completed on time. Local Christian businessman and president of ProBuilt, Jim Bell, said, when people pay you to do a job, they simply want you to do the job. They expect quality work, and they expect it to be done on time. We do that at ProBuilt. For references and dozens of pictures of both residential and commercial work, visit our website, ProBuiltInc.com. That's ProBuiltInc.com. Or call our El Cajon office at 619-593-2965. We're fully bonded and insured. California State License Number 567925. ProBuilt.
I'd like to remind all of my listeners that the Bob Siegel Show has a sister program on our sister station, KPRZ 1210 on the dial. Every Sunday morning from 9 o'clock to 9:30, you can hear City Voice. On this provocative program, my good friend George Runyon interviews a different local Christian ministry every week. You can listen to the show while driving to church, and don't be surprised, you may find it so interesting that you'll stay in the parking lot continuing to listen and skipping those Sunday school donuts. That's City Voice with George Runyon, every Sunday morning from 9 o'clock to 9:30 on our sister station, KPRZ 1210. But right now, you're listening to KCBQ 1170. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. Well, of course, you've heard in the news that Israel did agree to a ceasefire. So what does Hamas do? They go and immediately fire more rockets into Israel. Now, you knew that was going to happen. I knew that was going to happen. A trained chimpanzee knew that was going to happen, didn't we? I mean, who are we kidding? It would be laughable if it wasn't so sad and predictable. Now, if you've been following my show for the last few weeks, you know that I went to Israel recently. Had many political discussions with people, but was also just absolutely mesmerized by the beauty of the country and the archaeology. What a thrill. After having been teaching about Israel for some 30 years now, I got to finally see Israel. And on top of the Mount of Olives, our tour guide mentioned something I had heard before, that a great fault line runs from the Mount of Olives into the city of Jerusalem. Now, I doubt that they knew much about fault lines when the Bible was written, and this makes the prediction of Zechariah the prophet all the more marvelous. I'm reading from the prophet Zechariah out of the New International Version, Zechariah 14, 3 through 5, and then also verse 9. Then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations as he fights in the day of battle. On that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives east of Jerusalem, and the Mount of Olives will be split in two from east to west, forming a great valley with half of the mountain moving north and half moving south. You will flee by my mountain valley, for it will extend to Azel. You will flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. Then the Lord my God will come, and all the holy ones with him. The Lord will be king over the whole earth. On that day there will be one Lord, and his name the only name. Now, Jews have traditionally cited this as one of the chief texts predicting the coming of the Messiah. Messiah literally means anointed one. In Greek, the word for Messiah is Christos, and that's where we get the word Christ from. Christ, Messiah, anointed one, all means the same thing. This Messiah was to deliver Israel from her enemies and then rule the entire world with Israel as a headquarters. Now, here's an interesting tidbit. What Orthodox Jews expect from the initial appearance of the Messiah, many evangelical Christians, including myself, a Jewish evangelical Christian, we expect that in the second coming of the Messiah, or the second coming of Jesus Christ, whom we believe to be the Messiah. The New Testament teaches that Jesus will return from heaven and set his feet upon the Mount of Olives. In Acts chapter 1, he kind of returned to heaven from the Mount of Olives, and then two angels appeared to his disciples who were standing around scratching their heads and said, "This Jesus who took off will someday return just as you saw him leave." This is how we will know that the Messiah has returned. In fact, Jesus left an important warning. If his coming was reported in any other way, other than just coming out of the sky, we were not to believe it. Matthew 24, 23, and a lot of times we do have some new prophet from some new religion that claims to be Christ. Well, it's impossible, because when the real Jesus comes, believe me, nobody's going to wonder about it. It will be an event so clear that there'll be no room for opinion or doubt. Matthew 24, 23 through 27, Jesus gives this warning while he was here on earth. He says, "At that time, if anyone says to you, 'Look, here is the Christ,' or 'There he is,' do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and miracles to deceive even the elect, if that were possible. See, I have told you ahead of time. So if anyone tells you, 'There he is out in the desert,' do not go out. Or 'Here he is in the inner rooms,' do not believe it. For as lightning that comes from the east is visible even to the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man." Now, the controversies between Jews and Christians about whether or not Jesus claimed to be God or was in fact God, I've dealt with on other shows, and I don't have the time to get into that today. But for now, just for now, suffice it to say that Christians take the passage literally. They believe God incarnate, returning as Jesus, comes back to the Mount of Olives at a day we don't yet know of. Jews would take this passage figuratively to some degree, and that is understandable. That is fair, as Hebrew prophecy was written often in the style of Hebrew poetry, and it's not always easy to know when a passage has a literal or a poetic fulfillment. Jews would say that the real God does not have feet, and that the Messiah, not God, a man, touches down on the Mount of Olives. They would say God is represented in the passage by empowering the Messiah. Now, Christians, of course, would agree that these are the feet of the Messiah, and they would also agree that God does not have feet. They would explain by saying that Jesus is not God in his true original form, but rather a form he chose to take, an epiphany, they call it, similar to his appearance when he spoke with Abraham about Sodom. If you go back to Genesis 18, this is the Old Testament, not the New Testament. Abraham's talking to a man. He suddenly gets down, and he calls him Lord, and this man talks as if he's God planning to destroy Sodom. Now, does that mean God is a man? No. Does that mean God looks like a man? No. In fact, we're told in the Bible nobody can see God the way he really looks, that we'd drop dead if we saw him, not because God's ugly, but because God's so holy and radiant that we with our sin wouldn't be able to stand it. But this was an appearance. He took on the form of a man. So this, even in the Old Testament, the concept of God taking the form of a man is there. Anyway, let's sum this up. Both Christians and Orthodox Jews, or at least a good number of Orthodox Jews, agree that this passage is referring to the Messiah. Jews claim it is the coming of the Messiah with the power of God, and thus the Messiah's feet literally, God's feet figuratively. Christians would say that God and the Messiah are one and the same. As you can see, if Jews were expecting the Messiah to have a dramatic appearance in which he splits the Mount of Olives, defeats the enemies of Israel, and rules over the whole world, Jesus, in their eyes, did not fill the bill. Christians respond by saying that before the Messiah could deliver Israel as a warrior and rule as king, he first had to die for the sins of Israel and rise from the dead. That, too, was prophesied by Isaiah. I'm reading a passage from Isaiah 53. Verses 4 through 6. Surely he took up our infirmities and carried our sorrows, yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Isaiah then goes on to say, but he was cut off from the land of the living. That means he's dead. He was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people, he was stricken. He was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, though he had done no violence, and nor was there any deceit in his mouth. So they're calling this man the Anointed One, which means Messiah. They're saying he's going to die. They're saying he's going to die for the sins of the people. Could it get any more clear? Well, it could get more clear if they also were to claim that he rose from the dead, if only the passage had said that. Well, it did say that, and I'll read that part to you when we return to the Bob Siegel Show. This is Bob Siegel inviting you to tune in for the Rick Amato Show four nights a week here on 1170 KCBQ. Rick stays on top of the issues local and national. He also does some of the most stimulating interviews you've ever heard. That's the Rick Amato Show Monday through Thursdays from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. here on Intelligent Talk 1170 KCBQ. You can also find Rick on AmatoTalk.com. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. One of the questions that Jews often ask about Jesus, how could he have been the Messiah? The Messiah was supposed to touch down on the Mount of Olives, split the valley in two. Well, there is a fault running down the Mount of Olives, and I got to go to the Mount of Olives not too long ago. Got to see it for myself. And the Messiah was supposed to banish Israel's enemies, rescue Israel, rule as king. Jesus didn't do any of that. And that's because there was also another prophecy. There was something else the Messiah was supposed to do first. And we were reading from Isaiah chapter 53, which said that the Messiah would die and die for the sins of the people. And he didn't die by accident. I want to make that very clear. We always get into this big argument. Who killed Jesus? Was it the Jews? Was it the Romans? It was the Romans who literally nailed him to a cross. But there were members of the Jewish Sanhedrin who turned Jesus over to them. But it's an irrelevant question because Jesus planned to die. It was his purpose to die. That's how he paid for our sins. And it says that even in their own prophecy. By the way, this passage in Isaiah, for those of you that want to say that the church rewrote it, the Old Testament over the years remained in the hands of the Jews, not the church. We got it from the Jews, not the church. Yet it was the, I'm reading again from Isaiah 53 now, verses 8 through 12. Yet it was the Lord's will to crush him. Get that? It was the Lord's will to crush him. God didn't go, gee, I sent Jesus and he and the disciples were going to have a great time. They were going to take a trip to Bermuda together. And then the Romans killed him and messed up my plans. No, that was his plan. It was the Lord's will to crush him and cause him to suffer. And though the Lord makes his life a guilt offering, he will see his offspring and prolong his days. See, now he's alive again. And the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. If you don't think that really said he was alive again, I know sometimes you read scripture and people just go, oh, it's your interpretation. Well, then the Bible says it again. After the suffering of his soul, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. Could it be more clear? This guy dies for the sins of Israel, rises from the dead. After the suffering of his soul, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. By his knowledge, my righteous servant will justify many, and he will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will give him a portion among the great, and he will divide the spoils with the strong, because he poured out his life unto death and was numbered with the transgressors, yet he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. Sounds like something you'd read in the New Testament, doesn't it? Those are the words of Isaiah the prophet 700 years before Jesus came. Now, because of the prophecy's obvious association with Jesus, some, but not all, rabbis have tried to reinterpret this prophecy as a kind of allegory about Israel suffering at the hands of the Gentiles. Now, Israel certainly has suffered at the hands of the Gentiles, and this has been a horrible, unjustified event of human history. But this is not what Isaiah is talking about in this particular chapter 53. And frankly, ancient rabbinical literature like the Midrash and ancient rabbinical literature like the Zohar interpreted this prophecy to be about the Messiah, not about Israel. Now, here's a question, fair question. Okay, Bob, even if the Messiah was meant to first die and rise from the dead, where does the Bible predict two comings? It seems there was only supposed to be one coming of the Messiah. You are absolutely correct. Of course, the Messiah was only meant to come once. But prophecy is sometimes conditional upon the response of the people. Jonah, for example, predicted that the people of Nineveh would die in 40 days. The population all on their own repented, and God called off his judgment. Interestingly enough, Jonah never used the word if. The conditional word if was not used. He didn't say, you will die in 40 days if you do not repent. He merely told them they would die. The condition was implied nevertheless. Now, when Jesus came to Jerusalem, there was a big split between the people of Israel. It is a myth, an absolute myth, that all the Jews rejected Jesus. Many of them accepted him. And the original church was made up of so many Jews that before a Gentile could become a Christian, the church argued whether or not the convert had to first be circumcised. If he was a male, they didn't circumcise females. But the leadership of Israel certainly rejected him. And God will often deal with a nation based upon the actions of the leaders, just as he once chastised all of Israel for David's private census. If Israel as a nation had accepted Jesus, here's what would have happened. The Romans would have been very concerned. And Governor Pontius Pilate, all on his own, without the encouragement of the Sanhedrin, would have executed Jesus. And the Messiah still would have risen from the dead 3 days later, because he still had to do that. He had to die for our sins one way or the other. However, at that time, Jesus would have raised his army, taken up the sword, beat the snot out of the Romans, and delivered Israel once and for all, Jerusalem's second temple would never have been destroyed. Yes, it was meant to be one coming. But knowing that the people would reject him, knowing ahead of time what would happen, Jesus predicted the following. This is Matthew 23, 37 through 38. And just notice the agony in Jesus' words. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you, how often I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. Look, your house has left you desolate, for I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Now, I want to make an important note here. This prediction of Jesus is not an excuse for anti-Semitism. Let me say it again. This prediction of Jesus is not an excuse for anti-Semitism. If you want to see what the New Testament says about anti-Semitism, Paul the Apostle gave a grave warning against anti-Semitism. Read Romans chapter 11. He said it loud, he said it clear, he said it detailed. However, this verse right here in Matthew is an explanation of why Jesus needed to appear twice. His complete mission was conditional upon the acceptance of the people. Orthodox Jews who do not see Jesus as the Messiah still must account for the destruction of the Second Temple from a spiritual point of view. This is something they can't ignore or brush under the rug. For example, it is understood that the First Temple fell to the Babylonians because God had removed his protective hand from Israel. At least that's what an Orthodox Jew will believe, because that's what the Old Testament says. The sin at that time was idol worship. What was the sin leading to the destruction of the Second Temple? Well, not idol worship, but other problems such as a corrupt priesthood, people put in place as puppets under the Romans, sometimes by bribing the Romans. Many Orthodox Jews today will accept this explanation. They will say God was judging corruption when the Second Temple was destroyed. And that accounts for a good deal of what Jesus preached against anyway. So despite the differences, there is still considerable agreement to be found here between Jew and Christian. Now, maybe the best verse to conclude this discourse would be another prediction from Zechariah about the response of the Jewish people to the coming of the Messiah, this Messiah whom they are assuming is making his first appearance. And I'm reading now from Zechariah 12, starting with chapter or verse 10. And I will pour out on the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem a spirit of grace and supplication. They will look on me, the one they have pierced, and they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only child, and grieve bitterly for him as one grieves for a firstborn son. Now, are you catching this? You can find the gospel in the Old Testament. Isaiah tells us the Messiah will die for the sins of Israel and rise from the dead. Zechariah says that when the Messiah returns as a king and does what the Jews expected him to do the first time, what's going to happen? They're going to look. Let me read that again. They will look on me, the one they pierced, and they will mourn from the go, oh my goodness, the Messiah came to us 2,000 years ago or whatever it is. Maybe he'll come another 1,000 years from now, and they'll say 3,000 years ago. Another area where Jews and Christians agree, there will be no coming of the Messiah, first or second, until the temple is rebuilt. What the Jews call the first coming, what the Christians call the second, we all agree there has to be a rebuilt temple. But you would be surprised how quickly that might just happen. A couple of weeks ago, I told you about the third temple tour I took, because there is a third temple society in Israel today. Many evangelical Christians believe we are living in the last generation of history prior to the second coming of the Messiah. And similarly, a good number of Orthodox Jews see themselves as the final wave of people to witness the original appearance of the Messiah. One reason for such eager anticipation is the return of God's people to their homeland for the second time, as predicted in Isaiah chapter 11. Now, how do I personally assimilate these ideas? Israel's rebirth in 1948 is a fascinating fulfillment of prophecy, to be sure, but God already brought the Jews back to the Holy Land once before after a Babylonian exile of 70 years, and from that time it was 400 years later when Jesus came. With this in mind, we really don't know how long this third nation of Israel will exist before the second coming. Neither can we be sure that the long corridors of history might not weave another dispersion followed by a fourth Israel. Not that I expect this. I'm just listing honest possibilities right now. For what it's worth, I do believe this third Israel is the final addition before Messiah comes. But I also believe God's people must be humble and careful not to add predictions beyond what the Bible actually promises. Jesus said, no man knows the day or the hour. He also said, it is not for you to know the times or seasons which the Father has set by his own authority. But if you're not noticing the many prophecies that have already been fulfilled, then you're just not noticing what God is doing. This is Bob Siegel, just making the obvious obvious.
Thank you for listening to The Bob Siegel Show. The views and opinions are solely those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent KCBQ or its sponsors. The Bob Siegel Show was brought to you in part by the Law Office of Thomas Pinkerton, helping infertile families have children. Tom Pinkerton would like to invite you to help Bob expand his radio program by donations or sponsorship. For more information about Bob's ministry, go to www.bobsiegel.net. Here, you can read Bob's articles and get information about Bob's books. That's Bob Siegel, SIEGEL.net.
Is your fence teetering on its